Welcome to ClinPharm Pod. I'm Elena Webster, Deputy Managing Editor for the ASCPT Journal family. My guests today are Dr. Marshall Sommer, CEO of Uncommon Cures and Emeritus Professor of Pediatrics at George Washington University, and Dr. Janet Woodcock, former FDA employee. I'm thrilled to have you both here today.
We're really happy to be here.
Likewise.
So you have just published two review papers in Clinical and Translational Science titled Supply and Demand in the Mathematics of Rare Disease Drug Development, Why Choosing the Right Model is Crucial, and The Placebo Effect in Rare Disease Clinical Trials, Measurement Impact and Statistical Approaches for Patient as Own Control Designs. And we'll put a link to both papers in the description of this episode. I'd like to start out by asking you, how do the focal points of these two papers reflect larger trends and how we should be thinking about adequacy and evidence for new drugs?
I might start with that.
Please, Janet, go for it.
All right. Now, back in 1962, when the requirement for efficacy was put into the statute for FDA, so requiring drugs to be shown to work before they were put on the market, that was amazing. And then during that time and then subsequent 30 years, people developed the randomized controlled trial, often placebo controlled. And again, that was a scientific triumph. And we had solid evidence of what worked as opposed to what was before, which was anecdotes and testimonials and so forth. So this was wonderful, but it became super wonderful. In other words, people became so allegiant to it that they felt that's the only way to learn anything. And of course, we don't learn things in other fields. We don't randomize airplanes and see if they're going to fall out of the sky and so forth. There are other ways to generate knowledge. And so what has happened since 1962, where we hardly knew anything about biology, now we have learned about rare diseases, and they really weren't understood except as like acronyms with unpronounceable doctors' names, all right? But nobody knew where they came from. But now with the genetic revolution, we can actually understand many of them, what causes them, and we can also devise treatments. But we can't use an RCT because mathematically for these small heterogeneous populations, it isn't the right tool. But people have a lot of trouble with change and switching what they're doing, okay? And so we've had, the RCT, and we got to insist upon that, and we got to have it, and it's the gold standard. And then, and so we've had so many rare disease programs fail because there's been insistence on the wrong tool to evaluate the intervention. Marshall.
No, I mean, I couldn't have said it better. And if you go back to the 1962 authorizing legislation, it actually says just convincing evidence. I mean, I'm paraphrasing a little bit here. Nothing about the randomized clinical trial, which interestingly enough goes back to the 1700s and Benjamin Franklin and Lavoisier, of all things. And then, of course, in the more modern era. But it comes from a statistical background of an almost infinite number of patients to collect from. And, you know, the effects where placebo actually plays a big role. Rare disease is very different. You have a very limited pool. You know, the old sampling without replacement is definitely true there. You've got a handful of patients, and they're also all very different from each other.
Yeah.
One of the things the double-blind RCT really calls on is that you put in so many exclusion criteria because you get your patients as uniform as possible, and then you introduce your therapy. And it's a great way to distinguish placebo effect, things like that.
Right, because you can find the signal. You don't have that much noise.
Yeah.
You can randomize out the noise.
Right, but it predisposes those huge groups of patients, which you never have in rare disease, that are all kind of exactly the same, which you also don't ever get in rare disease. Numbers very small, but they're equally valid and appropriate models you can use statistically that have been around for a long time. Actually, look, in the early days, half the trials were open label trials where the patient was able to own control, things like that. It's actually kind of evolved towards people became more rigid around the RCT because it's a comfort zone. I think there's another thing going on here. FDA has always been very careful not to approve a drug that wasn't efficacious. So the false positive outweighs what I would call the false negative. The false negative being you actually, you know, didn't approve a drug that actually worked, but you just didn't hit the signal, things like that. And for these really big scale drugs, that's probably very appropriate. For these very small rare diseases, most of these groups, they get maybe one shot at this. You know, whether it's the families who pulled together their funding to do it, or it's a small biotech trying to get a rare disease drug across the borderline, you really need to pay attention to that type 2 error, that false negative error. And the RCT is really designed much more for that false positive than that false negative. So mathematically, you need a fraction of the number of patients using model designs like patient is the wrong control. We kind of use that. People used to call this N of one or serial N of one, things like that. But if you actually describe what it is, the patient is serving as their own control. So you're looking at their change. And then you're looking at all these patients and looking, okay, what was their slope? How did they do? And you need a fractional number of patients that you will for an RCT. It means you have to have a more, sometimes more complex design. But in rare disease, that's not a deal breaker like it is in something when you're doing some thousand patients, because you can actually focus more on the individual patients. And of course, next thing that always comes up is, well, what about the placebo effect? Well, that's kind of why I published these papers together. And the placebo effect is actually manageable, even when your outcome markers are things that are somewhat subjective, like a patient scored developmental quotient, things like that. And you can actually manage that. But in rare disease, a lot of these are diseases where there are good biomarkers. You know, take the enzymologies, you know, the inborn errors of metabolism, where you've got a biochemical defect. There are primary biochemical markers that are directly tied to the pathology of the disease. So you're not even looking so much at a surrogate marker, you're actually looking at the defect itself to see if you can move the needle on it, which is very different from what you'll see in a lot of other disease models in the,
right,
called the broader field. Janet?
It's good, as they say, confirmatory evidence. Patients say they're getting better. The biomarkers move in the right direction. And like Marshall said, often with these rare disease treatments, you're looking at the root cause and you understand the defect and you are trying to move the dial on that defect, whether replacing an enzyme, decreasing a gene function, increasing a gene function, whatever you're trying to do, you can measure that in the person. And in their cells, and often. And that is very powerful compared to like a lot of symptomatic diseases like rheumatoid arthritis or migraine. Did the people feel better and so forth? You can understand why you need to have large randomized trials in those areas, because it's really hard to tell. You don't even know what the root cause is. You're trying to treat the symptoms. I'd like to go back to the self-controlled study a little bit. I think people don't understand. They think it's just a series of case series or a series of anecdotes. But as Marshall was saying, you can insert rigor into that as much as you can insert it into an RCT. It's just a different kind of rigor. You can have look at trajectories of patients. You can pre-specify not only what symptoms you're going to follow, but also what magnitude of symptom for that patient, symptom reduction or what have you, would constitute success. And so there's rigor here that you can put in, but people haven't done that because they say, oh, we just have to do an RCT. And so they don't bring any creativity and thought to how you might evaluate a therapy like this, you know, in a small number of pretty sick people often.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. It actually brings me to another question. Can you briefly describe patient's own control trials, how, I mean, you know, sure, step by step, how those work and why they're so commonly used in rare disease research?
So what an own control model means is that you're looking at the patient's behavior off therapy. So whether it's a biochemical, take your pick, things like that. And then you introduce therapy. And then with that therapy, you observe, were they different when they were not on therapy? It relies on a couple of things. One of which is that patient, if you did nothing, was likely to look like they did before. In other words, if they're going along on their, you know, pathway here, and you hadn't done anything, it would be likely to continue, which is true for a lot of these.
That's where the natural history is very helpful for the disease
right.
overall. Is it progressive? Is it stable? Did people improve, say, because they're growing or something like that? You know, go ahead,
Marsh. Yeah. And then you can do things. So let's say that the drug effect is temporary. You can introduce the drug, withdraw the drug, so the tox possible, which is another kind of base of science here. And you can say, okay, was the patient different off and on this drug? And you can do that under very controlled conditions. You can even actually randomize that part, whether they start on the drug or they go off the drug, things like that. But it's kind of the basic premise here. You're looking at that patient's response to that therapy. And here's where it becomes really useful, because almost a bigger effect than what you would ever see in kind of the more common diseases is the difference from these patients. Let's take a disease I've worked with for years, urea cycle disorders. My youngest patient presented with 4 hours of age, and a patient with a defect in the same gene presented with 85 years of age. So you get these huge differences from patient to patient. And if you're looking at their trajectory of each patient, you can actually correct for that heterogeneity, as opposed to trying to get everything to average out, where you're never going to see a signal because right. your standard deviations are just going to be enormous.
So that means you need to follow each patient often before you put them on the treatment. So you get some baselines and you get a slope or a trajectory of the different. And you also, for each patient, Marshall hasn't said this too, but for each patient, there's even if they have the same disease, their symptoms may be different.
Yeah.
And so what we have is a whole lot of angst often trying to figure out a composite endpoint that would capture all these. But then they get it wrong and then the treatment, quote, fails and you have a type 2 error and so forth. So patient has own control. You can, in this run-in period, identify what's wrong for that patient. You also yeah. can ask the patient and the family rather than having some clinician say, you know, in my experience, this is, you can actually quantify those symptoms beforehand and then pre-specify how much improvement that you would expect that would be real substantive improvement. This adds rigor to what, you know, if you just sort of treated the person and followed, you know, you enrolled them and then just treated them, you really wouldn't know what to make of that. But if you do these other things, you can have a very rigorous design. Although, Marshall, you might want to talk about dealing with the placebo effect and bias yeah. and confounding, which is when people then they wave their hands and say, we can't believe any of this, even the enzymes, because it might have been a placebo effect somehow.
Yeah. And just add to what Janet said, too. I think one of the things about the patient's own control model is it does allow you to start using a composite of different outcomes, because these patients are going to be at different ages, different stages in their disease, you know, different places along the pathway. And I see a little RCT, there's a true, is angst is exactly the right word. What is going to be the one outcome we will pick that will apply? And you end up with what I would say pretty bad outcome measures, like 6-minute walk test right. and things like that, that just really aren't appropriate.
Right.
You know,
Yeah. One, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this,
no, go for it.
We had one where, okay, a bunch of the people were in wheelchairs and they improved so much they were able to walk, but you couldn't use their outcomes because they didn't have a baseline walk test. I mean, how reasonable is that? It's not reasonable. Sorry, Marshall, go ahead.
No, it's when form over function sometimes hits, what I'll say. Now, placebo effects are really interesting. And one of the things we've started playing with a lot is grading them by how subjective they are. Mm-hmm. So let's take the ultimate binary, live or die. That one's pretty objective.
Right.
You know, that's, I mean, some people maybe can wish themselves to death. That's probably mm-hmm. true. But by and large, not. That's going to be, okay, biochemical enzymes. I can try really hard, but I can't get my phenylalanine hydroxylase to perform better just by wanting it to be so. And I probably can't change my phenylalanine levels in my bloodstream too much by doing so. And then you kind of move from there. You know, radiographic findings read by, say, a blinded reviewer are actually very objective. Physician-graded videos, where they're blinded as to where the patient has been treated or not treated, pretty objective.
However, what the reviewers would say, well, there could be effort dependent, and the patient knows there's extinguishing of that behavior.
Right. And that's the next thing I was going to bring up, which is take pain scales, or let's say cognitive performance. If you ask parents, which are actually the most subjective, so, you know, take your binary live or die, and then you take parents reporting how their child is doing it. There can be as much as a 0.3 to 0.5 effect size from that. But as Janet just pointed out, that actually extinguishes over time. So if you look at effect size, it's a composite of the effect of the treatment plus the effect of whatever placebo. And that's even true in randomized clinical trials. There are still placebo effects there as well, too. But if you look at that over time, if it's true drug effect, it will stay constant, the effect size. So sometimes you want to watch them longer.
Yes.
And if it's placebo, it will be great over time. There's even some great mathematical formulas for that. They've done a ton of large meta-analysis on this over the years, and it actually is a predictable. But you can even do other things too. Let's say that you have something you wouldn't use as a primary outcome, let's say a hematologic marker, hematocrit that would respond to your therapy. It's not really your primary. You track that at the same time. And let's say your hematocrit or whatever you're looking at doesn't really change much of anything, but you get this nice response from the drug. It's called a placebo effect. But let's say they track together, then that means it's probably more likely to be actually drug effect. And then you watch that over time and see if it is consistent from that standpoint. So it's like everything else. You can engineer in good, statistically sound. And these are not new concepts. These are statistics that have been around for a very long time. We didn't go out and invent any new math for these papers. We just kind of pulled together what's already out there. But these are all things that you can actually handle.
Yeah, I would like to add another confounder that I've been involved in for many decades, all right, which is the enrollment confounder. Okay. So it won't happen in this kind of design because you've already enrolled the patient and you're following them. But for trials that have entry criteria, say rheumatoid arthritis or even hypertension is the most interesting one to me, because in hypertension, they were so surprised they found a little decrease in the placebo group in the blood pressure after they were enrolled. Well, how could that be? You can't wish your blood pressure lower, right? But what they found, which is so interesting, when they used the automated cuff, it didn't happen. Okay?
Interesting. So, it's when they were hearing the sound. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so the clinicians, because there were criteria for enrollment, they were rounding that up unconsciously, all right, to get the people enrolled. Similarly, slightly different, say, in rheumatoid arthritis trials and trials like that, osteoarthritis, the placebo group improves pretty substantially after enrollment. Okay. What is that? Well, that is they were enrolled at a time when they were feeling bad and they got better over time because the entry criteria mean you had to be up here. And there was probably some unconscious rounding up as well. But with this kind of design, you simply have to avoid that by following the patient over time. Then you don't have all this up and down. But this sort of enrollment period where you have to meet some criterion, like people would call this regression to the mean, this decrease, but really there are underlying factors that cause this. It isn't some magical whatever regression of some sort. But because you're aware of it, and that's what Marshall and I are saying, be aware of these factors, these potential confounders, a bias and placebo effect, and design around them or correct them mathematically so that you can be confident in the results. Don't just say, well, because of this happens, we have to have an RCT. Because if you had done a run-in period with those people, okay, then they would have settled to their base value, whatever it was, you know, rheumatoid arthritis, they're up and down, the hypertension would have come down or whatever. And you know, you can manage these kind of influences.
One of the things we did in the papers, we showed a graph that has the different effect sizes you can detect in how many patients. And then we kind of pick the standard effect size and things like that. And what she found very quickly is that the number of patients available for the majority of rare diseases,
yeah.
you simply don't have enough patients to do an RCT. So there's some great data coming out of Orchinault and others around prevalence of these conditions. We have a little bit of a chart in the table talking about, in the paper talking about it, but probably 80% or more of rare diseases have fewer than 150 patients in the United States.
I was astounded by this. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of them now under 50 and a lot of them under 10, because as after the Human Genome Project finished, we had the easy ones, you know, cystic fibrosis, lots of those, sickle cell, lots of those.
Right.
But then you start doing a lot of these channelopathies that cause seizures, a lot of these things that are developmental delay, and they may only be one patient, there may only be 5 or 10 patients, and they may all look kind of different from each other. So the classic models for this just simply don't work. And also, not only are they mathematically infeasible, they're economically infeasible.
Yeah.
Because the amount of, you know, are you going to take 20 years to do a study because you're never going to get enough patients for an RCT? Doing that, you know, sponsors going to be out of business by the end of the patient organization's going to have given up.
And the other thing about this, okay, these are also very tragic diseases, many of them, of children. So these dying children or children who, unless they get an intervention, are going to be severely compromised, really maybe never be able to function as adults, or tremendous suffering of the patient and their families. And so we should not allow our biases, talk about bias,
yeah.
bias toward an RCT. We should not allow that bias to inhibit us from actually trying to help these people, because sadly, the tools are now available. We have interventions, that genetic interventions, other kind of interventions that could help these children and their families and other people with rare diseases. But nobody's going to do this if they are told they have to do an RCT, you know, because it's not feasible.
So I did a little digging. One of the things I looked at was, what are the failure rates doing? And interestingly enough, in rare disease, the failure rates are nudging up. And I think some of that has to do with the fact that the diseases that are being studied are smaller and smaller populations. In the early days of rare disease therapy, a lot of them were more common diseases where you had enough patients where you could do an RCT.
Right.
And I plotted out how many of those studies failing were actually RCTs. And actually the RCT use had gone up some, and the failure rate went up matching that as the size of the populations and those diseases went down. Them just because that's all the patients that were available. So it's really almost a matter of necessity that we look at these other models. It's good science. It's sound statistics. It's just getting folks to think about it a little differently. And, you know, a lot of the people who design these studies, they come out of a large pharma background, which is the more right. common thing out there. And that's the model they know. And you tend to go with what you're kind of comfortable with. This just requires folks to step out of their usual zone a little bit. There's nothing risky about it. It's just different.
Yeah. Well, also on the review side, on the regulator side, there's a tremendous adherence to the RCT and possibly the reimbursement side as well, although journalies perhaps haven't gotten there yet. But so they need to be challenged a little bit. Okay. But yeah, if people just concede and bring RCT designs, what they do, in my opinion, Marshall, and you may say, is they overestimate the treatment effect, like 100% treatment effect, and overestimate their ability to recruit. Okay.
Always do. Yeah.
And then they have enough statistical power to barely scrape by, okay, if they do those things. And then it doesn't happen. The recruitment effort fails because you can't, because the people are so heterogeneous. And often, you know, not every intervention is going to be 100% effective. And so then the trial is stopped, or it concludes and is declared a failure, and that's it for the drug, like Marshall said, because there's usually just one shot at this. There isn't massive investment for something that has a market of 150 people. This is often funded by philanthropy or by patients' families having lemonade stands and selling cookies and so forth to get this done.
So as we're talking about the methodology that goes into these trials and things, what inclusion criteria or study types have been most informative? And where are we seeing the biggest gaps in the available data?
It's not so much the gaps in the data, it's just actually trying that different model out. I mean, obviously, having good natural history studies on a rare disease is one of the best places to start.
Right.
Even if you're doing an RCT, it's the best place to start because it allows you to identify relevant outcome measures and also understand the course of the disease, things like that. Having said that, patients by themselves are all quite different. So it's not so much that there's a huge data gap. It's not that there needs to be a giant project going to collect. It's really just getting folks to do design that is appropriate to the science of the disease. It's really, I'd say it's as simple as that, but it kind of almost is as simple as that.
Right. Well, for example, the statistical community, if you go outside of regulated products, you're going to find a great deal of creativity, use of Bayesian designs and so forth. But inside that, people sort of act like this is the only way. We have to have an alpha of 0.05, which is completely arbitrary and so forth, because I think it's people don't like to change. And also they may feel that's their power base or something. But I mean, this is a tragedy that these children are not being treated. And it is not ethical to insist upon unrealistic designs because, you know, we've seen companies flounder for years and not be able to advance their asset because they can't figure out how to do a design that would evaluate it in that disease.
If, for instance, when we're taking looks, and there's a couple of publications on this out there too, when you look at trials that fail in rare disease, 60%+ of the time, it's because of recruitment and retention.
They
cannot get enough patients to see the signal they're going to. For regulators too, I kind of understand it. They're much more likely to be publicly pilloried. You know, they approve a drug that wasn't effective or whatever. And if one just didn't make our criteria, there's not as much downside on that. Huge downside for the patients, though. So what we see is we'll see people trade regulatory certainty for trial success certainty. So they'll pick a design that is less likely to work just simply because that's something the regulators may be more accepting of. I've had a number of sponsors where, you know, there are people who are designing it saying, well, the FDA will like this. Well, whether the FDA likes it or not, it's horrible science and you're likely to fail. But it's funny, that drives the process because it gets them to their next funding level. If the FDA approves the trial, they go forward and things like that. Whereas on the back end of that, it may have doomed that trial to failure. And that's a mindset that Jane and I think we're both trying to change.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to recognize that patients and their families and their treating clinicians like Marshall want good treatments. And these other designs we're advocating are not inferior designs. They're alternate designs.
Right.
They can provide as much convincing evidence as probably more with the small patient population. They will provide more substantive evidence because the RCT is a population-based conclusion on statistics. It doesn't really tell you if you have migraine whether or not this drug is going to help you. Okay. But, you know, with this self-controlled design, you can actually look at the symptom, the people who had symptoms like yours, and see how it worked. And that's statistically allowed instead of like, oh my goodness, that's a subgroup analysis. It's not statistically valid and so forth. So, that's the other issue, and I'm involved with the Haystack Project, which we sent in a citizen petition to FDA asking them actually to write regulations. They have some regulations on choice of control, but to more strongly say that non-RCT development programs are not flexibility. They're not a substandard. They're not inferior. They will continue to be inferior if everybody insists on RCTs and they don't put their mind toward how would you actually rigorously evaluate these interventions. But everyone wants to know. They want to know two things. Does this drug work and is safe? Mm-hmm. And how will it work for me, okay, with my condition? And actually, the design, some of the designs we're talking about actually, I think, have more promise in that second ask.
And the other thing, too, is you may find that it's much more easy to identify subgroup. Let's say you're tackling a disease, and since it's open label, you're seeing everyone's response kind of in real time. You may spot very quickly, first off, a group that is not responding and actually is having trouble with the drug.
That's right.
And you can say, okay, you guys, you're out.
Right.
And actually, there's a nice early safety where you're just waiting until the end. It may just be, well, the drug didn't work for anyone, and therefore we're going to discard it. But you may already be able to say, okay, here's a subset of these patients. It's never going to work for, and it may not even be safe for them. So you're done. And then you can look at a group and say, it works great here. It's safe. It's effective. And so you have not discarded the effective drug.
Yeah, and you enrich for that group, and then you understand the actual treatment effect in that group. Or maybe they have a certain genetic defect. Maybe they have a certain kind of symptom constellation that the drug is more amenable for. Or sometimes, and this is fairly tragic, I think that it's early intervention. You may well find out that, okay, after X number of years with this disease, this intervention isn't going to help.
One of the things Jen and I've been talking about a lot of others is what we call the point of maximal impact. And this kind of comes to the whole issue of including children in research. And because the majority of rare disease does affect pediatrics, about 80%+, something like that. And if you, let's say, a neurodegenerative disease, which a lot of the genetic conditions that we're talking about here, that's one of the primaries. Well, if you wait and study adults, that disease has kind of run its course. It's kind of, you can say the cake is baked, but it often is.
And again, what you do then is you declare failure in a drug that, had you intervened early, actually been effective. Sorry, Marshall, but...
No, that's exactly where I was heading with this. And instead, you've really almost tried to design your study for failure.
Yeah.
In this regard. So it's kind of amazing as many have worked as they have. Whereas if you actually study the population, the age population that is most impacted by the disease, where the intervention is going to have the most impact, you use the model that's going to be most appropriate to show whether it does or does not work. It's really much better. The other thing for adaptive trial design, there's something everyone throws around. What that means is you do a few patients and then you look to see how it's doing and do I have my numbers right? Yeah, my outcome measures right. With a double-blind placebo control, that becomes incredibly complex and also really hard to kind of tell what's going on. With the open label, it's pretty obvious. So not only can you keep a drug that looks like it's going to work, and maybe you need a few more patients, maybe you don't need as many, but also if it's very obvious right off that this drug is not doing anything for these patients, you stop and then you move on to something else. It preserves capital, which is a kind of a callous calculation. And is also, there's only so much capital for these, and we want to make sure it's precious and we want to make sure it's well used. So that means stop something that's not going to work, but don't throw away something that was going to work.
As we're talking about patients, I would really like to move into talking about what the role of the patient is in a patient's own control trial design. How do these designs mitigate placebo-related bias? And you might also, if one of you would, take a second to define how you're looking at placebo bias in the context of these trials. Where might they fall short with this patient's own control design?
We talked about this a little bit earlier. Different types of outcomes have different levels of placebo bias built into them.
Right.
Very objective biochemical, radiographic things, those have very little placebo bias in them. Janet also brought up something earlier, which is a bias, which is regression to the mean. Patients who qualify for a study are often quite sick. They oftentimes may get better during that point in time. So it's like, ooh, you're not better. Great. And some of the way you design around that is by the length You have to do these things a little longer. So you have to have a longer observation period.
Right.
But you're doing fewer patients. So that's actually a very reasonable trade-off from that standpoint. The other thing is, like I said, you match subjective outcome markers with objective markers so that you can cross-validate. It may be that your objective marker, like I said earlier, I think you said an example of a hematocrit, but it can be growth velocity. It can be a number of different things. You can match those against the thing you're really interested in seeing if you're improving and saying, okay, yeah, these are tracking together. That's much more likely to be treatment effect than not. So placebo effect is kind of, everyone uses that as kind of like the boogeyman on clinical trial design. The placebo effect, like I said, it's a spectrum of things. If I ask you, is your child beautiful? That's probably going to have a big placebo effect in there because, you know, of course your child's beautiful. They're awesome. Are they beautiful over a long period of time from an objective observer? Maybe not. And that's where you can actually correct for those things by trying to have some objective, but also extending over time from that as well, too.
I think the run-in period, there are many things you can do during the run-in period to mitigate some of this. For example, you can actually switch them over randomly to a placebo and then at some point put them on the active, depending on the kind of active it is. So that placebo effect would have occurred when you have the placebo. This is different than the RCT, which statistically balances, tries to tease out the placebo effect versus the treatment effect in a population. This tries to tease it out in that person, right?
Yeah. And it hides the start time. It basically says, at some point in time in this period, we're going to start you on the drug, but you're not going to know exactly when.
That's right.
Yeah. And
that won't work for all kinds of designs, okay? A lot of these drugs, like Marshall said, are going to have objective biomarkers that'll help. We talk in the paper also about mathematically correcting what is the placebo effect in this disease. You also, with more prolonged observation, there's a extinguishment of that effect to some extent. So you can do many things. It's going to depend on what the intervention is like. Okay, gene therapy is going to be different than, well, take gene therapy. That's a good example, though. How are you going to do RCTs in gene therapy? Okay, to be right. And why aren't we very creative in thinking of, or our best thinking hat on about how do we evaluate this intervention, right? And really nail it and have confidence at the end, not saying, oh, we're being flexible because this is rare. No, we're saying this is substantial evidence that would convince experts that this drug really helped these people and we understand the side effects. So I don't think you can give a single prescription for how to deal with the different kinds of bias, because again, there's effort dependent bias. So, okay, a lot of these diseases, say neurologic diseases, you have tasks that you do, right? And that's, or you talk or you walk or you do peg insertion or something like that. Okay, well, potentially you could do more of that if you thought you were on treatment. So you think through that and you mitigate it rather than throwing up your hands and saying we have to have a population-based assessment of the placebo, which is really what the RCT is.
Yeah. And realize that there's a grade of placebo effects across different outcome measures. I think everyone paints a very broad brush. Well, placebo effect is in everything. No, it's not.
Right.
I mean, I can't make my enzymes work faster or, you know, depending on what I'm measuring, things like that.
I've always wondered, and this is a separate issue, but, you know, I've worked with Ted Kapchuk at Harvard on his active open placebo, right? And it turns out if you just give people a placebo and tell them what it is, they will still improve. But they only improve on the subjective symptoms. They claim their breathing is better, but their pulmonary function tests haven't improved, haven't changed, okay, any more than they would change anyway. So that's something I always wondered, if you gave active placebo before you do your intervention, have you canceled out much of the placebo effect?
Here's the open placebo section of the trial.
Run in. Yeah.
That's a great concept.
Yeah, but we don't know. We don't know how much, whether you get even more placebo effect when you think you're on, or effort dependent when you're not on open placebo, you're actually on, you know, you're on the treatment. And again, these designs will need to be modified depending on the nature of the intervention. You know, if you can put it on and take it off, and you can do crossovers with the patient, that's extremely powerful design. But then that's not for most of these treatments are not like that. So what we really need is creativity and thought instead of just default. Okay, it's not an RCT, therefore it's inferior, and we're just going to throw up our hands.
That actually brings me to a point that I did want to discuss. Are there specific design features that the two of you are seeing in trials that are having a really big impact? And conversely, are there some fairly common mistakes in trial design that you think are limiting or, you know, even as you were talking about earlier, being invalidated, basically, there's not enough evidence to make a conclusion. So if you were able to give people a checklist of yes, try this, or maybe leave that one behind now, what would you say?
I actually have a checklist I give folks because we evaluate a lot of trials that come to. I run a program now that does nothing but rare disease clinical trials. The first one is know what the population size really is for your disease.
Be honest
Everyone,
with yourself.
you know, it's I found I cannot tell you how many times I've gone to a center and say, "Oh, how many patients do you have?" "Oh, I've got 40 patients." Well, and do you think they'll all enroll? Oh gosh, yes, they've been very loyal to me. Usually, what you find is that patient. That person may have seen 40 patients over the years with that. They may have five that actually are, you know, would be suitable for the study you want to do. So there is a huge overestimation. I think Janet alluded to it earlier in how many patients are available. So the first thing is get a realistic appraisal. And that's one of the things natural history can help you with. If you have an active, ongoing natural history, you found those patients who are interested in participating. So that's one thing I would say from an advice from that standpoint. The next is try to find outcome measures that are not only important for the disease, relevant to the patients and their caregivers, their parents, but also are things where there are some robust measurement tools. And a mistake that I'll see made a lot, well, is it validated for this disease? Well, this disease may have 10 patients. Of course, it's not validated, but you look and say, okay, in similar type situations, has it been used consistently, things like that. The other is reaching for the RCT. I see a lot of, also, you know, they will have hired a regulatory team that is used to the big pharma model. And it's like, well, of course it's an RCT. And a mistake they make is then they're afraid of the FDA. They're afraid somehow that the FDA is going to tell them no, and then we'll hold a grudge against them for telling them no. So I've actually seen folks afraid to use the best study design. Because they thought the FDA won't like it. And somehow then the FDA is going to talk bad about them and carry a grudge. And that can happen. I'm sure it can happen, but that's not been my experience in working with the FDA. They want to try to get the best treatments to the patients. So you've got to take your best model there. And then you've got to convince the FDA why it's the best model.
Yeah, I mean, I tell people to lead, don't follow. Okay, do the best science possible. Even if the agency tells them to do X, Y, and Z, if it's not going to work, don't do it because you're going to fail, okay, most likely. So I do see, like Marshall, a lot of wishful thinking about the number of people could be recruited in the size of the treatment effect. Oh, it's going to work in everybody, and therefore we'll have like very high power. But my biggest gripe is about the outcome measures. I just feel really inappropriate ones are selected. Yeah, this thing about quote validation and that population, that's a bunch of BS. Okay. You can't do that when there's hardly anybody in the population. And frankly, you know, when I started at CDER in 1994, okay, and even when I was over at CBER before, and they were approving various biotech drugs and Center for Biologics as well. Most of the outcome measures had been adopted by habit. They'd been used for a long time in the clinical community, and so people were used to them. I mean, people use like the Likert scale, and they just use it for everything. How much pain do you have? You know, you put something, and that had been validated like generally as reflecting something, right? But certainly not for all these diseases, and so forth and so on. And I feel like it's partly my fault. Like, Because I raised these questions. Well, Marshall, I'm sorry, but I raised these questions. I said, well, how do you get new ones? Well, we can't just keep with the ones we have. And how do you decide if a new one? And so we formed groups, but they became like enamored with measurement science. And then they became so rigorous. And, you know, psychometric testing is one thing because it's all subjective, okay? But to decide whether walking upstairs or whatever, you want to understand certain things about that, but you don't need to have every single thing that you did for some psychometric analysis, because those are all like how somebody feels or whatever. So now I think we're in a difficult situation where the clinical outcome assessments, the agency's asking for a tremendous amount of rigor in every population. And that, you know, it's not feasible, especially when before what we're currently using, many of them were, quote, never validated. So what has happened is that, and this is in the Haystack petition, is that the agency insisting on inappropriate outcome measures for some of these trials.
Yeah, and I've seen that too. And it's such a shame too, because, you know, you're not going to be able to validate an instrument on a group of 5 to 10 patients or 20 patients in any reasonable period of time. But right. Remember that one of the beauties of using patient as own control is you're actually looking at the slope. And so if the instrument you're using is reasonable,
right,
has things that are, you know, fairly straightforward things, looking at that slope becomes a reasonable thing, particularly if it's things that the patient community views as important to what they should be doing.
The slope cancels out a lot of the problems that you're trying to deal with the validation, as long as you're not below the floor or above the ceiling of the measure. And you can test that out with the individual patient. Because in my mind, what the rare disease development program should do is if you have a natural history study, if you don't, you want to start one, okay, as you're contemplating developing an asset, follow that. Unfortunately, this is expensive, but at some point you transition the patients from the natural history study to the observational phase of the intervention. Okay, maybe well before you're going to get into the clinic. Then you have a long period where that patient has been followed more rigorously with the outcome measures. And there you can experiment and see what actually captures that person's symptomatology best.
And Jim and I actually worked on this a couple of years back with the National Organization for Rare Disorders, which is the NORD I Am Rare program, which FDA provided part of the funding. It's actually a cost-effective natural history study with a lot of rigor. CPATH actually works with it for their accelerator program. And so you can actually build one of these in a very cost-effective way, I would say. The annual costs for it are quite good, and they've got good data sets and things like that. And so you can build up that. And that's one of the biggest mistakes I make is people don't invest in those. A company or a sponsor that's working in their CMC period where they're trying to get their drug ready, they should be also at that same point in time building that natural history study. And it gives something back to the patient community. Because one of the things I like about the NORD program is registry the natural history studies. We use these terms interchangeably, sorry, belong to the patient community.
Right.
But they have data in there that can be useful for the clinical trial. So you pre-position so many things and you're starting to test your outcome measures by looking at how much you can capture them in that natural history study.
That's right.
You brought up something earlier, Jenna, that I find very true. It's how many things someone used once, not necessarily for particularly great reasons, but suddenly they get into the lore. 6-minute walk test. If anyone spent more than 10 minutes with me, they know that's one of my pet peeves. I remember when we used it in Pompe's disease a long time ago, it was the only thing that had any signal. But it is so actually placebo prone, because if I've got a nurse walking or I've got myself walking that patient through there, and I'm in a cheerleader mood that day, I can guarantee you I'm going to get a longer 6-minute walk test.
Go for
it. You know, I've got cheerleaders, stuff like that. Whereas if I'm like, yeah, walk, I'll keep up with you. They're not going to walk as far. And so getting good measures is where I think natural history studies really, really shine. And also, like I said, pre-condensing the patient population so you have a realistic assessment of what's available.
Agreed. Totally agreed.
Well, we are quickly approaching the top of the hour, but one of the things that I have loved as you have talked about this is how much what you're talking about and the way that you're coming at this and thinking about these things is patient-centered. I mean, personally, I love to hear that as a person who goes to doctors. Also, I want to say that that's one of ASCPT's core principles that we try and promote, and especially clinical and translational science with that bench to bedside scope that we have. So I think I'd like to wrap up with just one more question for you both. I know that most of the people reading these papers will be probably involved in drug development or, you know, clinical trialists, but end users, talking about people who care for the patients with rare diseases or patient advocacy groups, how would you advise these people to interpret this research and these proposals?
I'll take this way. This is really designed for you. So for the patient groups, the patients themselves, this is the place where your voice can be heard. This is the place where you can help shape the design and the potential outcome of these trials by helping get the best model. I think one of the things that's different about rare disease, like I said, I spent 40 years working with patients with rare disease, it is so much more personal. It is so much more, I hate to use the term bespoke, than anything else I've been involved with. And so for the patient group, this is your chance to get the trial that you deserve, but you better speak up.
Yeah, I like the speak up part. In my mind, I have been amazed since I left the FDA at how much patient advocacy groups are actually involved in all these matters. They, you know, start by helping patients, other patients, then they raise money and give it to researchers. Then maybe 10 years later, 20 years later, they're there. We don't have any treatments. What's wrong? And then they look at the development path and they see that there are problems. So I would say, number one, comment on the Haystack petition that's before the agency. Send in your comments. I would say, consider that your involvement in advocacy for the correct designs and endpoints and so forth is legitimate. It is authentic. It is the right thing because the patient groups are focused on the outcome. They want better treatments or some treatment for their disease. And they know that these things, these changes Marshall and I are talking about, I think, really are necessary if that's going to happen.
Thank you.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. This has been fantastic. I love listening to you guys talk about all of this. You're so passionate, and we're very excited to be sharing your research with CTS readers. But I really appreciate you coming on here today and sharing even more thoughts and insights with listeners. So again, appreciate your time.
Great. All Take right. care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to ClinPharm Pod. Be sure to check out past episodes while you're here, and remember to visit ascpt.org for updated podcast releases, our latest webinars, and the most recent issue of all three journals.